A Biblical Theory of Marriage. The first talk in a series titled Understanding Love, Sex, and Marriage was presented by Jack Crabtree on October 1, 2002, at an evening class of McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side. Technical difficulties resulted in the loss of the first few minutes of this talk.
Everything can be reduced to simply these mechanistic natural forces. And that's the ultimate truth about reality. Well, that's far from the biblical worldview. The biblical worldview is that any mechanism that you discover in the world is simply an artifact of a creator God who created it. And what exists more ultimately than nature is the God of nature, the creator of nature. And the God of nature is a person, a rational person, an intelligent person, the source of our rationality and the source of our intelligence, is a rational person who is creating what he created and the world that he created for a reason. There was purpose, there was meaning, there was significance to everything he did. Well, when it comes to, that's what a philosopher would call teleology, a teleological view of the world, that each and everything that you see in the world has a telos, a purpose, a goal that it was seeking to meet. When it comes to the issue of sexuality, which of those worldviews you approach the question from makes all the difference in the world. And the given in the culture at large and down at the university down the street, the little university down the street, the view that would prevail there is this naturalism that makes no room for teleology. There is no meaning, there is no significance, there is no purpose. There is simply the given, the biological givens. So from the anthropologist's perspective down here, what is marriage? Oh, well, marriage is simply something that human beings created because they were thrown into this world by the evolutionary forces of biology. They were thrown into this world as sexual beings with sexual desires and sexual capabilities, sexual potential. That was the given. That's the truth, if you will. And we human beings are faced with that truth, and we have to do something. We have to channel that energy. We have to control those desires in a way that will be beneficial to the growth of the race, to humanity, to society, to civilization, and so on and so forth. So somewhere in our distant past, we invented marriage as a way of channeling and controlling, putting some kind of lid on the sexual energy and the sexual impulses that were the real truth, the real given of human existence. That's precisely not the biblical perspective. The biblical perspective turns that completely on its head. From a biblical perspective, the given is ultimately the design and the purpose and the goal of the Creator God. And of the two, sex and marriage, the one that has the priority is not sex, but what has the priority is marriage. Marriage was not created for sex. Sex, from the biblical perspective, was created for marriage. Now, we're going to explore that in a lot of different ways and in a lot of different lectures as we go through here. But tonight, we're going to talk about a theory of marriage. And the thing that we have to understand right up front is that marriage has the place of privilege in the biblical worldview. God intended marriage. He created sex to serve the purposes of marriage, and sexuality has its meaning in relationship to this greater purpose of a husband and wife being married. Okay, so what is its purpose then, if that's the case? We don't actually have any direct and explicit statement in the Bible that would tell us why God created us to be married. But I think we can, and so what I'm going to say here is somewhat speculative, but it is informed by my understanding of what the Bible says our whole lives are all about. That if our whole lives are all about this, it does really make sense that God created marriage for this purpose as well. And my experience bears this out, and the experience of many other people that I've talked to. It seems to me that the fundamental purpose of marriage is to be a unique and a particularly intense training ground in wisdom, righteousness, and faith. That is, my reason for existence in this world, just even existing in this world, is ultimately to become a child of God, to become someone who loves God, knows God, and desires to serve Him and to serve His purposes. That's the biblical perspective. If we don't like it, then everything that we're going to say here is bunk. But if that's true, the reason God created marriage was to be one more classroom, one more arena in which we come to know ourselves, we come to know our God, we come to love our God, and love what our God stands for, our Creator stands for. And in the context of the very difficult task that we are faced with in marriage, if we keep our honesty and our integrity and our humility about us, we have ample opportunity to learn wisdom, to learn who God is, to learn who we are, to learn what life is all about and existence is all about. I think that's the fundamental purpose of marriage. Now, like so many things that God created, what their purpose is and what the reward is are two entirely different things. That God's creation is full of serendipitous little goodies. He could have made marriage a fairly uninteresting institution, and it could still be the training ground that God intended it to be. But as it happens, God has so designed it and so created it that there's a very special and unique joy that arises out of a marriage that is a sound and healthy marriage. We'll talk a little bit more about what exactly is the nature of that joy and that reward. But marriage is a good thing. It's a wonderful thing. It provides us with a kind of fulfillment that all of us instinctively and intuitively sense, even when we don't understand it. And that's why we are drawn to marriage, because we know that it has something to offer me that I really long for and that I really want. So, yes, it's a good thing. It's a desirable thing. But its purpose is not to bring me joy. Its purpose is not to bring me the reward to make me happy. Its purpose, like everything else in life, is to be the arena in which I become sanctified, in which I learn to be holy. I think it's a very common and a fundamental error that all of us make in Christian culture and outside of Christian culture, that the reason to get married is because it will fulfill me. And typically, if I go into marriage with that as my goal and that as my purpose, the reason to get married is so that it will fulfill me, then if it somehow fails to fulfill me, then that's a reason to get out of marriage. But that's not what the Bible has in mind. Yes, it can be very rewarding. It can be very fulfilling. But that's not why I'm doing it. Why I am doing it is to learn obedience. The closest thing we have to a definition that helps us understand the design of marriage is in chapter 2 of Genesis, as part of the creation account. Let me read 18 through 25, but I'm particularly going to focus on verse 24. Chapter 2 of Genesis. Yeah, 2:18. Then the Lord God said, "It is not good for the man to be alone. I will make him a helper suitable for him." Out of the ground the Lord God formed every beast of the field and every bird of the sky and brought them to the man to see what he would call them. And whatever the man called a living creature, that was its name. The man gave names to all the cattle and to the birds of the sky and to every beast of the field. But for Adam there was not found a helper suitable for him, or maybe more literally corresponding to him, might actually be a better translation. So the Lord God caused a deep sleep to fall upon the man, and he slept. Then he took one of his ribs and closed up the flesh at that place. The Lord God fashioned into a woman the rib which he had taken from the man and brought her to the man. The man said, "This is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman because she was taken out of man." And here's verse 24, which I think defines marriage from a biblical perspective. "For this reason, a man shall leave his father and his mother and be joined to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. And the man and his wife were both naked and were not ashamed." Adam senses something he's created with, something missing, something lacking. God creates takes him to the animals that he's created and says, "You want a pet? You know, we're one of these. Meet this longing of your heart, this need that you have." No, they, even having examined them and studied them enough to name them, they don't seem to be what he's missing. So God then specially, in a special act of creation, creates one corresponding to him, his equal, his partner, his counterpart, and woman, and brings woman to him, and she is the one that he was looking for. And then the definition of marriage is given. You've got the creation of man and woman, and then because you have the creation of man and woman was created for this very purpose, to be the helper corresponding to him, Moses comments, "For this reason a man shall leave his father and his mother and be joined to his wife, and they shall become one flesh." Okay, let's analyze this and look at what it is he's saying. There are a lot of ways we can misunderstand, I think, what he's saying. First of all, there's nothing in the Bible that would suggest, even though it may ring this way in our ears, there's nothing that would suggest that the marriage ceremony nor sexual intercourse, sexual intimacy, actually brings us into some metaphysical state of oneness. I think a lot of people misunderstand this passage along those lines. I can remember when I was in high school or college, people who would, in some moment of weakness, would have sexual intercourse, and then because of this verse, they would decide, "I am under obligation. I have to marry that person because we are already one. We have already been joined into one by the act of sexual intercourse." Neither the act of sexual intercourse nor the act of marriage, from a biblical perspective, makes you one. That's not what he's saying, I don't think. What Moses has in mind here is the nature. Marriage is fundamentally a contract. It's the taking upon myself of a moral obligation. I have a moral obligation to do a certain thing. Well, what is it that I have a moral obligation to do? I have a moral obligation to leave my father and mother and cleave to my wife, for one. And secondly, I have a moral obligation to become one with my wife. That's the work of a lifetime, not the metaphysical magic of a moment. And it's crucial to see that. Otherwise, we don't understand, I think, what marriage is, and don't understand the biblical perspective on marriage. So, it's not a metaphysical state. It is a moral obligation. The one fleshness of marriage is an ideal that I am seeking to realize. It's not something that can come about by the tinkling of a bell in some church service. We see here that it, and we'll talk more about this later, but just briefly, this is an obligation taken on between a male and a female. The sexual difference, it seems to me, is critical for the purpose that God has in mind for marriage. Because I would argue that the difference between male and female is more radical. There's more distance between a man and a woman than there are between different ethnic groups, different racial groups, any other differences that you find in the human family. There's no greater, more significant, more unbridgeable difference than the difference between male and female. And God is bringing male and female together and having them take on the obligation of becoming one. You who are so fundamentally and radically different, I want you to become one. And the impossible challenge of that, the work of that, is the purpose, I think, of marriage. It's what gives marriage its purpose, because it's in taking on that task that if I will have the humility and the courage and the honesty, I will learn about myself. And I will learn about the nature of sin in the human heart. I will learn the real depth of self-centeredness. I will learn all kinds of lessons about myself that are crucial to my sanctification and are fundamental to wisdom. I will become wise by taking on that task. So we have a male and female taking on a moral obligation to become one with one another. Okay, and not only become one, but to leave father and mother and cleave to one another. So let's analyze those two aspects of the commitment. First of all, leave father and mother and cleave to his wife. What's really interesting here is this verse is so out of place. This is written in a time and a place and culture where no husband in the land would ever leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife. You were always fetching the woman and bringing her home. You didn't leave your home to go to her home. She always came to your home in this culture, in this time and place. It is striking that out of that culture came this comment. A man will leave his father and mother and will cleave to his wife. Why? Because this is mutual. She may be changing her address, but you better be leaving your father and mother to cleave to your wife. This is a mutual commitment of two individuals to one another. What does it mean? I think what he's trying to describe is, in the marriage relationship, I'm entering into an obligation, I'm making a promise to my wife that I'm going to grant her the highest loyalty that I give under my loyalty to God. Obviously, from a biblical perspective, no human being ever gets the loyalty that belongs to God and to wisdom and to goodness and to truth and what is right and what is just. That is obviously always a priority, must always be a priority. But under my obligation to God himself, the highest loyalty I am granting to my spouse, to my wife or husband. I think that's what he means by you will leave father and mother and cleave to your wife. Your father and mother in that time and place and culture would have been, up to that point, the highest loyalty you had. I mean, you were loyal to your parents above and beyond anyone else, anything else. And the biblical text is saying, but you forsake that loyalty in order to grant that loyalty to this woman. In our context, our family relationships have been badly bruised and badly broken in modern times. So it's not necessarily our parents that my loyalty and my allegiance to my parents that's going to vie for my loyalty. It may be friends. It may be work. It may be my work environment. It may be any number of things that I would be tempted to give my loyalty to. But if I'm going to fulfill the obligation of a biblical marriage, they must not compete with my loyalty to my spouse or my loyalty to my husband. That's the promise we're making. What exactly does it mean to be loyal to? Loyal to do what? Loyal to have regard for the interests of my wife above and beyond the interest of anyone else. Loyal to care for her before I care for anyone else, to attend to her before I attend to anyone else. Exactly what that's going to look like, I think, is one of the challenges of marriage. And I think we have to not be glib and invent little rules and formulas too quickly here. It's going to depend on the context. It's going to depend on the people. It's going to depend upon what really is ultimately in our best interest. The temptation on the part of a woman is going to be to say, oh, this sounds great. The moral obligation is for my husband to make me the little queen or princess in my throne. And the temptation the other way is we men go, well, duh, of course, I'm to be king and master. And I have my own personal slave. I mean, that's going to be the temptation to see this loyalty here in those terms. But obviously, that's not right. Obviously, that's not what he's talking about. We have a mutual relationship of mutual regard, mutual love, mutual care, mutual attentiveness to one another, all under our commitment to what is right and good and true. So my obligation is not to give you what you want if you're my wife. my obligation is to do what is good for you. And that gets tricky. Because you want what you want, not what's good. And I want what I want, not what's good. And my wife's obligation is not to give me what I want. My wife's obligation is to truly serve me and to have the goal in mind of making me into the man that God wants me to be and have that be a priority in her life and vice versa. So exactly what that's going to look like is the challenge. That's what taxes us. We wrestle with that. We worry about that. We get perplexed by that, not knowing how really best to care for our wife or husband. But although we might get perplexed as to how to do that, we ought to be clear on what it is that is my priority. That should be clear. My priority is to have first and foremost the needs, the interests, the concerns, the growth, the wisdom, the sanctification of my wife in mind, and she mine. We can think of some real clear cases where there's a violation of this. You know, you think of a wife, for example, listening to the advice and the desires and the concerns of her parents, totally disregarding the desires, the concerns, and the interests of her husband. Because habit. She's lived with them longer. She trusts them. They're important to her. It's a very natural thing to do. But it's a very wrong thing to do because it violates the promise that marriage is. In marriage, we are promising to take that loyalty that we have given our parents and give it to our husband instead. Same thing with children. When children come along, it's very tempting for children to become the focus of a mother's attention. It's not wrong for the children to be the focus of her intention. I mean, she is their mother. That's the right and appropriate thing to do, but not to the exclusion of being focused on the concerns of her husband. And all too often, it's tempting to do that. If life gets hard with the old man, well, I've always got the kids. That's a violation of the promise that we've made. A husband whose life revolves around his work. His activities revolve around his work and the work environment. His work has become a mistress. He is violating the promise that he's made to make his wife the center of his life in that sense. I think when you begin to see what we're talking about here, leaving father and mother and cleaving to wife, making them the absolutely the most special person in my life, we begin to see what instinctively and intuitively it is that we like about marriage. What it is that we see as the potential reward of marriage. We who are so alone, who are so isolated, who can feel so invisible, can feel so unimportant, can foresee a relationship where I am the most important person in somebody's life. There's no way we don't instinctively recognize how good that would feel to be that special and that important to somebody. And that's true. That is precisely part of the reward of marriage, when it is a healthy and a sound marriage and the promises are indeed being kept. And that's why failure in that regard is so painful. It's a betrayal, a form of adultery. You know, even if it's not, it has all the emotional impact of adultery. When someone close to me, who's made an obligation to make me the most special person in their life, throws me away, disregards me, sheds me, and replaces me, granting their loyalty and their allegiance to someone else. That's painful, and it's a pain that we absorb at the cost of the relationship. So that's the first thing that we're promising, that kind of special loyalty, that specialness in one another's life. The other thing is a little bit more difficult to grasp. The two will become one flesh. Okay, what are we talking about? Well, I've already mentioned that the one flesh is not some kind of metaphysical merging of our beings in the third heaven. This is nothing spooky here. That's not what he's talking about. By life in both Greek and Hebrew is oftentimes used to describe, flesh. The word flesh is often, in both Greek and Hebrew, is often used to describe a human existence in this world. My time in the flesh is the time that I have physical existence here under the sun. We can even count the number of fleshes in Greek and Hebrew, the number of people with physical existence. So even though flesh fundamentally means the stuff that hangs on the bones, metaphorically it can represent simply a physical existence of a human being. But as such, it can come metaphorically to represent just a human life. And that's the sense, I think, in which Moses means it here. When he says the two will become one flesh, there's going to be this change in their outlook, this attitudinal change, where instead of two people living two separate and independent lives from one another, existing on parallel tracks, maybe intersecting every now and then, we are making a commitment to not look at our lives that way any longer. Instead of being two lives on two separate parallel tracks, we are going to be two people living on the same track from now on. We are going to live one life that we share, not two lives that we talk about with each other. And I think that's the metaphor that he's trying to get at. The two will become one flesh. The ideal that we are striving to attain in marriage is lives so mutual, lives of such mutual regard, mutual respect, mutual understanding, that we are sharing one life together. So what does that look like in practice, I think? Again, it's fundamentally attitudinal more than it is behavioral. I mean, different people are going to do this in different ways, and I don't think we can prescribe one and only one right way to do it. But there's this attitude that is being prescribed by this promise that I'm making, and that is that I no longer look at myself as being separate from my wife. If she is afraid, then I must understand her fear. If she has ambition, then I must understand her ambition. If she has goals, I must seek to understand her goals. Whatever it is, I am making a commitment to make my life a study of this person that I have married. I am going to get to know her, and in knowing her, share her life, so that her life is not out there apart from me. Her life has become my life because of my understanding and empathy with it. And that becomes mutual. I become my wife's life study. To know me, to understand me, what makes me tick, what are my values, what are my priorities, and so on. Must she agree with them? No, not necessarily. But she must seek to understand me enough and respect who I am enough that that she's in my life, that she is sharing my life with me, and vice versa. This is not about losing our individuality, I don't think. I mean, again, this is probably the most common way that this is understood. Okay, woman, we're supposed to become one flesh. How's about you just submitting your will to mine, and that'll just sort of take care of it. You be my clone, and that's one. I mean, that's how it can typically be understood. It's not my business to absorb her person and make her me, or make me an extension of me, so that I can live my life, nor the other way around. We remain the created individuals that God created us to be. We can't really ultimately be otherwise. We are who God created us to be. But we can either be who we are alone, in isolation, alienated and unknowable to one another, or we can make it my goal to have our lives merge through mutual understanding. Mutual understanding and respect. This is, again, we'll touch on this more in a lecture later on, but this is where the sexual differences become pretty important. My wife is a woman who looks at life in a completely different way than I do. And there are times when it totally baffles me, her perception of reality. I don't get it. I don't understand it. And the tremendous temptation is to simply say, I don't understand it. This is absurd. This is stupid. This is silly. This is foolish. This is ridiculous. Get over it. Stop being a woman. I can respond that way, as many, many men, the vast majority of men over the course of time, have done. Or I can recognize this is the creation corresponding to me, the one created for me who has equal value, equal significance, equal validity to her perceptions. God created her this way. There's nothing wrong with the way she sees the world. It's just different than mine. And if we are to become one, I must seek to understand it. I must seek to understand how she experiences the world. Because how can I be one with it? How can I identify with it? How can I in any way merge with it if I don't even get it, if I don't even understand it? And vice versa. We are just as mysterious to you women as you women are to us. And that's just the sexual difference. And above and beyond the sexual differences are all those individual differences forged in us by our culture, by our upbringing, by all those things that make us who we are. And the task of marriage is to understand and respect that. Again, this, I think, is part of, when I put it the way I put it, hopefully it resonates. There's something in us that says, I would love to be known like that. I would love for someone else outside of me to know me intimately, to understand me and not reject me, to understand me and yet respect me and accept me for who I am. Well, wouldn't that be wonderful? And as God designed marriage to be, that's what indeed it will be if we keep our promise to one another. But of course, as we all know from bitter experience, marriage can be very, very, very painful. If someone comes to know me and rejects me, then we see this wrenching pain, emotional pain. Marriage promises much, but at great risk. And we often feel the pangs of the risk rather than the joy and richness of the reward and the fulfillment of marriage. Okay, I think I've covered the ground. So let me open it up for your questions. We haven't talked about how sexuality plays into that, because we'll save that for a later lecture.
This wasn't really brought up in the scripture, but I'm curious to what extent the promise and the loyalty goes to just a friendship, between best friends. That kind of relationship. How should we...
Well, I think friendship can be profoundly and deeply intimate in a way that comes close to and matches the intimacy of marriage. I think it can. But there's a huge difference between a friendship and a marriage. If you and I are really good friends, and then over the course of time we have different experiences, we go different directions and we drift apart. We do so not having broken any promises to each other. I never promised you that I would become one flesh with you. You were just a good friend. So I never made any obligation that through thick and thin, through all the difficulty, through all the work and through the hardship that it is, I'm going to know you and I'm going to understand you and I'm going to respect you. So if we indeed drift apart, I may regret that of having lost something that was really wonderful and valuable to me, but I haven't betrayed you, nor you me. So I think that's the fundamental difference. The most striking difference between marriage and friendship is marriage is forever. Marriage is for keeps. And that's part of the purpose of marriage, I think, is it's this obligation that keeps me bound where I can't run away. I can't righteously bail out. And because I can't righteously bail out, I've got to deal with the issues that emerge out of any conflicts in our relationship, and that's where I can get to know me. And I think that's one of the purpose. I think that is the primary purpose of marriage. Did I answer your question?
I appreciated your distinction on the one flesh about the difference between it not being just a metaphysical reality. I think I have synthesized those or kind of blended them together. So I'm curious about Jesus' words about God making joining them together, and also especially in Malachi 2, where it says, "Has not the Lord made them one in flesh and spirit? They are His." If you'd comment on those passages.
Okay, yeah, that's a good question. I probably haven't given sufficient thought to that, but my an initial reaction to that is I've always assumed that Jesus is understanding Genesis in roughly the same way that I am. And so what he means by God joining them is in this contract, in this covenant, in this obligation to one another. So what he's objecting to in the Pharisees is what the scriptures see as a sacred covenant that two people have made with each other, you guys see as a disposable relationship. And what's with that? What God has joined together in the sacred covenant, no man should be trying to undermine and trying to destroy. Okay. That's how I see it. Without having looked at it more, I don't know that I can prove it from the text right now. But
a similar sort of thing then in Malachi 2, where it says, "Has not the Lord made them one in flesh and spirit? They are His." I mean, that's the same idea.
I would take it the same way.
It's God honoring the covenant.
Exactly. Uh-huh. Yeah, that's how I would take it. Yeah.
Okay. So I'm wondering when one of the partners isn't honoring those daily commitments to hold the other in like positive regard.
I'm sorry, I can't hear you.
When one person isn't sticking to the deal, even though it's not outward adultery, you know, you said there are some things that could happen in one's attitude that could parallel adultery. So would you consider that to not be a bona fide marriage?
Ah, okay. Well, we'll talk about divorce and all that in a later lecture, so I don't want to steal somebody's thunder. But no, what makes a marriage a bona fide marriage is that I've made a promise. I mean, if I've made a promise, I've made a promise. I mean, that comes back to his question. That's what, when it says what God has joined, this is a sacred promise before God that we're making. We are before our Creator saying, "Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to take on the work of making this the most special person in my life and becoming one with them. I promise to take on that task and to do that job." That's a sacred promise before God that we're taking on. If I have made that promise, I have made that promise, and that is a marriage. If I don't keep the promise, it doesn't mean it's not a marriage. It means I'm not doing what I promised to do. It's a moral failure on my part, but it doesn't sort of invalidate the marriage, if you understand what I'm saying. We can often use that as a rationalization, that because I haven't kept my promise, this is not a real marriage. Because this is not a real marriage, it's okay for me to leave because it's not a real marriage. Something to that effect, and we can rationalize along those lines. But the fact of the matter is, if I'm not keeping my part of the bargain in the marriage, what is the right thing for me to do right now? To start keeping my part of the bargain. To cease my faithlessness before that promise and to begin being faithful to the promise. Now, I don't know if that is even getting at the heart of your question, though.
I guess I'm curious about the person who is keeping the promise.
Okay, what is the attitude of the one who is working on it?
Not choosing to not keep your promise just because the other person isn't. You still would want to honor your commitment.
Okay. Well, I'm sure we'll talk more about this, but my short answer would be it takes two to make a marriage. It doesn't take two to keep my promise, but it does take two to make a marriage. It seems to me that from a biblical perspective, it is always the right and good and noble thing to do to keep my promise anyway, even if my partner is not. Having said that, there are ways in which my partner can so not keep their promise that they do such damage to me that God in His grace and His mercy has said there comes a time and place where you just need to walk away. I mean, the interesting thing is that Moses did, the question that came to Jesus was, why did Moses instruct them to write certificates of divorce? And Jesus' answer is not, no, he didn't, which is the way we interpret that passage. No, he didn't. He would never do that. God hates divorce. God doesn't like divorce. Jesus recognizes that there is a time and place where divorce is a necessary evil. Divorce is a necessary solution to a very tragic situation. That would be my perspective. But, you know, the human heart is so deceitful that instead of having the nobility of hanging in there and keeping my promise and hoping that God will, in His grace, will touch the heart of my husband or wife and fix it, we can prematurely decide, oh, good, they're not keeping the promise. I can get out. I didn't like the bum anyway. And that, you know, obviously that's the wrong perspective, the wrong attitude. But we'll have a lot more to say about that.
One of the sort of rules of thumb that a lot of people in the church have is that believers should not be married to unbelievers. And I think the way that you would probably construe that from your definition is, if someone doesn't understand marriage to be this contract that's leading to my sanctification, that would qualify them as an unbeliever if they were not understanding marriage in that way. So how necessary is it for someone to understand this perspective of marriage, that it's for my sanctification, that it's for my righteousness in going into it, in that issue of believers and non-believers in marriage? I mean, should the church say, no, we can't ever marry non-believers because they don't understand the purpose of marriage according to the Bible?
Let me just start talking, and somewhere in here I'll answer your question, maybe. You can... the first problem in the way Christian culture in general has looked at that issue is we're so simplistic in our definition of Christian and non-Christian. I mean, when Paul writes that, he doesn't actually say, well, I guess he does say believer and unbeliever at one point, but first he says, what fellowship does light have with darkness? It's not an issue of, have you identified with Christian culture or not? I mean, how many people have rationalized a marriage, have justified a marriage by getting the fiancé or boyfriend or girlfriend to convert to Christianity? They're totally clueless about the gospel and God and anything, but sure, they'll call themselves a Christian. And then they consider it not unequally yoked because they are, after all, Christians. That's not what Paul's talking about. The unequal yoking that Paul is talking about is light and darkness, belief and unbelief. So it comes down to what you're describing. Do you have two people who are on the same track in their relationship with God and truth and light? If they are, then they are equally yoked. If not, they are not. Now, what is Paul's concern? Paul's concern is not out of a kind of Puritanism, not out of a kind of sense that unbelievers have unbeliever cooties and you really don't want to get any on you, which is sort of the perspective that I had growing up, is that, yes, believers and unbelievers shouldn't have anything to do with one another because they're tainted, they will make you unclean. Paul clearly doesn't have that perspective because he specifically counsels in that same letter, are you married to an unbelieving brother or sister? Stay married. It's not a problem. Your children are clean, he says. Or sanctified, they translate it. But what he means is kosher. There's nothing unkosher about the relationship between a believing spouse and an unbelieving spouse. It's perfectly all right. But what he's envisioning there is a situation where you had two people married to one another, one became a believer and the other didn't. And the believer is wondering, well, do I have to get a divorce now? Because somehow they are making me unspiritual. And to that he's saying, no, of course not, don't be silly. He doesn't say don't be silly, but no, of course not. When he talks about not being unequally yoked, he's saying, what if you're this side of marriage and you have the opportunity to decide whether and where and when and to whom you will marry. Why would you marry someone whose destiny is darkness? You are to become one flesh with them. You are to understand them. You are to empathize with them. You are to respect them. Can light respect darkness? Can light understand darkness without being absorbed by the darkness? I mean, you're deliberately and willfully entering into a dangerous and treacherous and difficult situation. Why would you possibly do that? So that's the perspective he's taking. And it's not this simplistic perspective of, do they call themselves a Christian or not, but do they get it? Do they really know what human existence is all about? Because you want to marry someone who knows what human existence is all about, if you have the option. Did I in any way answer your question and all of that?
But to continue on Chris's question, having this particular perspective on marriage doesn't necessarily... I heard in Chris's question, like, is it necessary to have this perspective of marriage, like, to marry a believer?
And I don't think the New Testament ever says so or addresses that. Is it important? I think so. I just think that would be important in any case, that someone who's supposedly entering into a marriage relationship understands what a marriage relationship is. What am I doing? What am I saying? What am I claiming? Am I promising something? Am I not promising something? What am I promising exactly? The clearer we can be on what exactly it is we're doing, the better it is. And it would be foolish of me to marry someone who doesn't have a clue as to what marriage is.
Right, but I guess my struggle is that it seems, although it's harder, it seems to be better to look for someone who's actually living that out than can necessarily articulate it.
Oh, well, yes, certainly.
Okay.
Yeah. You could find people who have listened to my lectures who can articulate a theory of marriage who are not one bit committed to it and understand it. That's true. It's far better, far more important, significant, that they are the kind of people that keep their promises, and they're the kind of people that understand that their promises are forever. I mean, if you've got... You could marry someone like that who doesn't understand the theory of marriage at all, but they have the character to be able to do marriage. And that's certainly far better than knowing the theory.
Yeah.
Good point.
I've heard you speak on this topic a few times. But one thing I wanted to ask a little bit, and I think I probably know what your answer is or along the lines, but I wanted to just ask it anyway. We live in a really selfish culture. And one of the things that's highly valued in this culture is one's individuality, particularly as it's defined by our culture. And I think, Christians, broadly speaking, I think absorb the beliefs of the broader non-Christian culture a lot more than they like to admit.
Mm-hmm.
With that in mind, I think that when we're talking about two people deciding that they're going to, in a sense, live each other's lives, so to speak, even though they are entering into marriage as individuals, they've decided that they're going to live this out together. And you talked about how that doesn't necessarily mean that I give up my individuality. I think that on the one hand, that needs to be addressed just because that is a real big fear. But on the other hand, I wonder how much of that is a really big fear because we have a certain view of individuality that is not biblical. And I'm curious what you would say of what is one really giving up or might one really give up in a marriage, in a marriage of commitment, and at what point can you say you've crossed the line in that you're giving up too much, and in another way, how can you say that there maybe is a lot of things you could give up that you aren't really sacrificing what's ultimately important?
Okay, good. That's an excellent point. Obviously we have to die to our individuality in order to become one, and I didn't emphasize that at all, and I really should have. I mean, that's a very important point. There's no way to become one without dying to my own ambitions and my own dreams and my own control of my own life as if I were free and to make my life the way I wanted to. Because one thing I'm doing is now all of a sudden I have to take into account the impact of any decision I make on somebody else now, which is just the antithesis of selfishness and the kind of selfishness that characterizes our culture. And that's why we chafe at it, I think is what you're implying, and I think you're right. We chafe at that because the very idea of living for somebody else is just offensive to me. But that's exactly what marriage is that I am all about living for somebody else now. See, there was a second part of what you were saying. How far? Yeah. There's so much in the New Testament where I was thinking about this the other day in another context where somebody has harmed somebody else grievously. And person A over here thinks that person B owes them this tremendous debt because of the harm that they've done. Person A over here sees things differently and doesn't really think they owe them anything. Seems to me that the Apostle Paul would come into that situation and say to person B, you know what? God was in control. God has done so much for you and has given you so abundantly beyond anything that you ever deserve by offering you eternal life. Just forget it. And so person B here forgets the whole thing and takes the attitude from the heart, genuinely, authentically from the heart, you know, you don't really owe me nothing. Paul would counsel this person, you didn't harm them, really. You know yourself that well, huh? I examine myself, and I'm not aware of anything against myself, but I'm not by this acquitted, Paul says. There are depths of evil and selfishness and harm and destructiveness in me that I even don't know and don't understand. So if someone thinks I harmed them, I probably did. Why don't you pay them everything that they were, you know, pay them everything that it cost them. You know, whatever harm, make up that harm. Take the whole thing. And, you know, if you have, instead of being this wide gap preventing reconciliation, all of a sudden you have that much room for negotiation and compromise and reconciliation. Because this person is willing to forgive it all, and this person is willing to pay it all. There's plenty of room in between for there to be a reconciliation where anything that is given is seen as mercy, and everything that is withheld is not seen as stinginess. And so there's room for reconciliation. Marriage is like that. If I enter into a relationship with my wife where I owe her complete, total, 100% service, this relationship is 100% about me serving her. And her perspective is, this relationship is 100% about me serving him. Now there's just oodles of room for meeting in the middle, where we can just have this, we can have this dance that we enter into, where anything I do in service to her is above and beyond what she expects, and anything she does in serving me is above and beyond what she expects. Did I get that right? And we are completely loving one another and experiencing it as love and experiencing it as mercy, as caring, as goodness, because we don't have these expectations that have bound us off and kept us separate from one another. So anytime I willingly decide to lay down my life in order to serve someone else, I'm not losing my identity. I'm not losing my individuality. I'm expressing my individuality because I did so voluntarily. It's when someone takes it from me and I wasn't willing to give it that I have lost my individuality. I have lost me. So it seems to me the biblical perspective is not you make sure nobody takes yourself away from you. You know, you make sure nobody robs you of your individuality. I think the biblical perspective would be, yeah, make sure nobody robs you of your individuality because give it up first. Express your individuality through servanthood, through service. Express your individuality through a willingness to submit and make that you. Make that who you are. And if you will do that first, then nobody can take it away from you. It doesn't really answer your question because in terms of where you see the boundaries, I think that gets worked out in the ebb and flow of life. And I don't think there are any hard and fast rules about that. But we have room and freedom to learn how to relate to each other if we're willing to give it all up.
Not to hog the floor, but to kind of just take it a little bit where I'm coming from, which is, I think, I mean, you're addressing it in a little bit different direction than my question was, but just the idea, the fear that people have that they would enter into a marriage, they would idealistically give of themselves and just keep giving, and they would give up a bunch of things that maybe they could have got if they hadn't gotten married, or if they had decided to stick it, you know, say, well, I'll get married, but I'm not going to give up these things. You know, they go ahead and they give it up, and then 20 years later, they feel like they gave up all this stuff for nothing. I think what I was thinking of is just a lot of the pressures that we have on us are to have our cake and eat it too, and that's possible, particularly because we're Americans. But, you know, I think people all over the world, in one way or another, would like to be able to enter into marriage and have all the good stuff of marriage, but also have all the good stuff of the rest of life, mm-hmm. including a career or whatever that may be. Mm-hmm. And that they, I guess where I'm getting at is, it seems to me you can enter into marriage and you can really give up a lot of things in this world. And yet, when all is said and done, you haven't really, it could work itself out that you ultimately haven't really given up anything of true importance.
Right, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Well said. There's two things you're getting. You're getting the reward of someone holding you as special and someone knowing you and respecting you, and that is a wonderfully rewarding thing. The marriage has to work. They have to do that, but that's the potential that's there in marriage. And then secondly, even if that doesn't happen, I have still learned... not necessarily, not infallibly, but I have had the opportunity to know myself and my God. And one way or the other, however we get there, however we get to know God, that's why I'm in this world. And so I gave up a career and wealth and whatever else in order to get that. All that's trivial by comparison to the eternal state of knowing and loving God. And I have to value that, to recognize that. But if I do value that, I recognize there isn't anything I gave up that's really worth all that much. And then you hear the testimony of people who have kept the career and kept the money and kept the freedom and kept the lifestyle that they wanted and die bitter and lonely at the end of their lives because nobody knows them. I really don't think there's any trade there. I would much rather be known and poor than rich and alienated from everybody, myself.
Jack?
Yes?
Is this on? You said something that interested me. You were talking about, I think you said something like a husband or a wife was created for the other.
Mm-hmm.
So, you made it sound like it was, that was part of the plan, that these two people would end up. Is that true?
I see what you're asking me. Well, yes.
Okay.
But not in the way that I used to think. That when I was a child growing up, the image I had is God created me, and then God created that woman out there who was destined to be my spouse, and he put me in the world to find her. My job in life was to go find her and to be asking the question, is this the right one? Is this the right woman for me? That's not what I meant. I don't think that's right. I do believe that all of life is determined by God, so the fact that I married Jody, the fact that I married the woman that I married, was destined to be. She was the one for me. But she's the one for me because I married her. I didn't marry her because she was the one for me, if you understand the distinction that I'm making. I don't have to ask the question, she's godly, she's wise, she's righteous, she loves God more than any woman I know, she has all of these other attractive and desirable features, but is she the right one? Don't need to ask that question. If I want to marry her, if it is my desire to commit my life to her, if I am willing to make the choice to try to learn to be the right kind of man to her, then she's the right woman for me. You know, as long as it's not foolish to marry her because she's ungodly.
And so divorce plays into that if she's just so destructive, or if you're just so destructive that, I mean, you're just making, you're just taking away that other person's ability to even just deal with life. And
yeah, that if you have so damaged one another that you can't make that commitment to one another, you can't keep that promise to one another any longer, then a marriage becomes irreparable. And that's, I think, where divorce comes into play.
We still have time.
Yeah, we do.
I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about what Paul has to say about the relationship between marriage and the church. And I don't mean some disembodied church, but I mean like concrete body of believers, or if he says anything at all.
Let's see. What does he say? Well, let's see. There's the Ephesians passage where he talks about the husband is the head of the wife as Christ is the head of the church. Are there any other passages where he uses that? Well, Christ is the church is the bride of Christ. I would argue that those are just metaphors, purely and simply. And as the bride of Christ, there are other metaphors that say, I think, the same thing. We are, on the one hand, gifts that the Father is granting to the Son as the church. We are spoils of war. It's as if God has gone in... No, I'm sorry. That's the other way around. It's as if the Messiah, our champion, has gone into battle and he's won us as captives, in as spoils of war, and he's taking us back to the temple to deliver us up to God. Basically, created reality... When Jesus is called the firstborn of all creation, and when it is said that it is with a view to him that all things were created. I think that's often mistranslated. They translate it through him all things were created, as if Jesus were the chisel that God was using to... I don't think that's what he means. I think it's with a view to him all things were created. The point being that Jesus is the centerpiece of God's creation. Jesus is the apple of God's eye. Jesus is what this is ultimately all about. He was going to embody himself in a human person and make that human person who was him, God, to be the main character. And we are, in a sense, and we mustn't get offended by this, but it's true, we are, in a sense, just props for the story that is going to get played out for the sake of the Son, in effect. So, in that sense, we are the bride of Christ. We are that precious, dear, treasured individual that's being given as a gift, if you will, to be the bride of the bridegroom, Jesus. I think that's the metaphor. And then in the headship metaphor, that gets terribly abused, I believe, because all Jesus is trying to say there is, here's the kind of attitude that you should have toward your role as head, husbands. Take the same attitude Jesus did. He's a head. And as the head, what did he do? He died, he sacrificed, he served. So don't get uppity. You know, yeah, you're the head, but have the same attitude about your role that Jesus, who is the head of the church, had in relationship with the church. Be the servant. Be the one who submits. Be the one who dies. Be the one who sacrifices. Take that attitude. That's all he's saying there. Unfortunately, there are people who read that passage as if what it's saying is God created marriage to be a picture of the relationship between Christ and the church, and if you don't do your marriage right, you're messing up the picture. As if there's some kind of metaphysical obligation I have to keep the yin corresponding to the yang in balance. You know, I need to keep the picture. I'm going to wreck the reality if I mess up the picture or something like that. And that there's something metaphysical happening here. And that's why you husbands, you better be the heads in your home, and you better make sure that your wife knows that. That's just a distortion. That's not even what he's saying there. I'm sure we'll talk more about that, too. Time for one more.
What are the challenges people face if they didn't have the right-created biblical view of marriage modeled to them, how did they work through those challenges?
Wow, yeah, that's a good question. I hesitate to answer that because I don't know if I can answer that adequately, because I have been gifted with such tremendous models, and my parents left me a tremendous legacy. And so I have never walked in the shoes of someone who has to overcome those obstacles. So I'm afraid that my answer would not be out of any real understanding of how difficult it could be. I believe it's difficult because I have seen people struggle. I've seen my own wife struggle with that. I believe that it's difficult, but I come up against a boundary in being able to help my wife and being able to understand my wife's struggle, because I've never lived through it. I don't know what that's like. But that's a good question. And I guess all I would say as someone who can't speak out of experience, but I guess what I would say is it becomes very important at a point like that we believe in biblical authority, and that we believe what the Bible is actually teaching us, not what we've seen modeled with our own eyes. I mean, the question, it becomes a crucial question of faith at that point, is where does the truth lie? Because everything in us is going to be inclined to think that the truth lies in what I have seen. And that's going to be kind of our default mode, is that, well, that must be the way it is. Mm-hmm. And I think we have to believe tenaciously in biblical authority and the divine revelation of the scriptures to believe that, no, this is what it's all about. This is what marriage is supposed to be. This is what it can be. And that's what I'm going to make it be in my life.
Okay.